This is Get Lit with Literature, and this is Monk. There's more at the website, allbook-books.com. And my Substack page, Musings from Between the Lines. The most recent little essay is about 2025 AD. Did you know that the new year is actually a Vatican Roman Empire holiday, so to speak, reinforcing the system of domination? The Anno Domini is what AD means. So that's the consciousness we're all astoundingly caught up in to some degree. So that's what I wrote about. And segueing to the part of the domination system that Stephen Newcomb writes about in his excellent, also Substack page, The Domination Chronicles, is the technology being used in that way. A recent interview with Chris Hedges with people that lost their jobs. They worked for Meta, Apple, and Microsoft. So the technology was being used. They were pointing out part of it was about suppressing support or voicing for Palestinians while allowing it for the Israelis. So this reminded me of how the technology is being used to prop up Israel and their genocide. And this reminded me of the IBM punch cards, which were used in World War II as a form of organizing and keeping track of stuff. So the technology, the underlying issues are the same, but the technology, as I see it, as exacerbated to this global scale. So that's some of what we're facing nowadays. And then also interestingly, an article at RT caught my eye, why Dostoevsky is trending on TikTok. So basically his novel from 150 years ago, White Nights, is speaking to the people nowadays, the younger people especially, because it's how to deal with loneliness and isolation and atomization and such like. Showing people you're not alone, that this is something that's been going on for a while, which got me to think that, okay, that's good. It'll help comfort people. It'll help them transcend the immediate, you know, immediate mire of the internet and the world as technology. But thinking outside that box, what were the social, geopolitical, and social conditions 150 years ago? So it's getting beyond that. And so we don't, as a species, keep regurgitating the same old, same old. So that's my introduction to part four of Jonathan Crary's excellent book. I highly recommend it. It's not long, but it's very dense. It's dense meaning the way it's written and worded is, it's as if it was a 300-page book, but it's only 124, so. Jonathan Crary's Scorched Earth, Beyond the Digital Age to a Post-Capitalist World. So, before I get into the last chapter, which surprised me because the chapters are just numbered, 1, 2, 3. I had no idea what it was going to be about, so it's a big surprise. It's basically about the I and the voice, EYE and the voice. But before I get into that, I wanted to, because of the book, the jacket and the explanation, the blurbs seemed to, I was expecting a way more negative book about the technology, but so I kept a list while reading of what I would call the solutions or positive things to encourage. So I just want to get those in now before I start tearing at it. Some of the highlights for me in the book is he accentuates the need and the need for cooperatives, communities, scaling down the 24/7 use of the energy, the 24/7 capitalism, tuning in with the natural rhythms, community, relationships, human warmth, spontaneity, town meetings, discussions, dialogues, debates. This is much of what he talks about, the spontaneity and the unknown and the spontaneity that happens when people gather, when they aren't being programmed and just glued to their screens. Living reciprocal relationships. true social interaction, land, the experience from the land, all our senses, using all our senses, that's what's being numbed to a great degree, which is why this last chapter is eye and voice. And the contrast of the internet and the screens, and it's all very eye-catching, and the attention span is getting shorter and shorter, and the ability to concentrate getting shorter. So I contrast that with Zen or meditative, whatever your meditative practice, because that takes time, and answers don't necessarily come right away. They could, in my experience, they come in a flash, or they come in days, weeks, years, decades. But the way that the technology is going, it's removing the sense of that it could come in days, weeks, decades. Because it's 24/7 on demand. Now, so I experienced that the other day. I was at a coffee place and I was thinking about Carreri's book, because he was talking about how people gather in the social scenes, but they're all on their screens. So I was at a coffee place and I looked around, and I would say there was three young women sitting around talking. They were just talking. Somebody else maybe was doing something else. I forget what, drawing or something. But then everybody else was on their laptop, maybe the cell phone. And then I was doing some editing of a manuscript. So I was, and maybe looking at my cell phone once in a while. So overall, it was about 75 to 80% of the people were on the screen. So that's some of what Carreri highlights, is that this sort of numbing of the interaction. I mean, people are getting work done and such like, but the social interaction and what can come from that is being squelched by the technology with everybody with the screens. A bit of a long-winded intro to get to the chapter, but I find that that's good to connect some dots with what's actually going on in the news and connect it with the book. So I'm just going to leaf through, read some highlights, make some comments. There's a lot to get to, so I don't even know if this is going to all be in part four. It'll probably go to part five because it's a longish chapter. Again, he's got phrases that jump out at me, as well as sections that explain a lot. Here's a phrase that jumped out at me: the delusional belief in the inevitability that our lives must be lived online. And then a striking phrase: the colonization of consciousness, the homogenization of experience. He's talking about, he's paraphrasing another writer, but those are very powerful phrases there. Colonization of consciousness, the homogenization of experience, and the anesthetization of the senses. Both worker and consumer are dispossessed of knowledge of communicative abilities of desire. And here he cites the Paris Commune in Europe between 1905 and 1919, 1956, Hungarian uprising, New England town meetings, workers' councils, actual contact with others, community, the rhythms of the day. The Zapatista movement, which just had an anniversary, having come out in 1994, January 1st, they have what are called encuentros, a community meeting, large or small, where debates of all kinds take place between equals. So here he is citing all these examples of the, in a way, the opposite of everybody on their screen at the coffee shop. People are communicating, talking, interacting, coming up with ideas and solutions, and just finding different ways to resolve things instead of what's web searching it to get some answer. And he cites a book I started a while ago, but I found it a little challenging, but it's got some great stuff that also highlights the colonization of consciousness. Guy Debord's, Debord, The Society of the Spectacle. Debord was one of many for whom the encounter was essential for resisting the spectacle's suspension of a common life world. So that's that phrase right there. Again, he's got these phrases that just make me stop and think. Suspension of a common life world. It's like, you know, instead of just the everyday commonalities being the focus, it's the cyber world that becomes the main focus. The spectacle, he wrote, produces a, quote, systematic organization of a breakdown in the faculty of encounter and the replacement of that faculty by a social hallucination, an illusion of encounter. end quote. It's not difficult to see the internet complex as continuous with developments that were well underway in the 1960s, but today's social media perform an even more sweeping eradication of community. So that's another one. A long time ago, I wrote, how did this phrase come to mind? People are walking around in a trance of otherness. A trance of otherness. It's like forgetting that we're all interrelated, all connected. Roger Waters' favorite line, walking down the street, I am you and you are me. It's just respecting that sense of the interconnectedness of humanity and all beings, and not the other, which has many obviously violent repercussions. But so that phrase touches on that for me, the social hallucination. It's like this whole rituals that go on. As Debord and others noted, spontaneous or unprogrammed forms of being together became irreconcilable with the rationalization of consumer society. And here's what I would call turtle medicine, but the unspoken truth is that face-to-face encounters entail too much wasted time to be compatible with the speeds and financial efficiencies of online exchange, and no data can be extracted from them and instantly put to use. So the turtle medicine is taking the time to meet and have encounters and not the other way all the time. The value of a face-to-face encounter has nothing to do with some misplaced sense of its authenticity compared to telematics or other kinds of remote contact which have their own authentic features. Rather, the direct encounter between human beings is something other than and incomparable with the exchange or transmission of words, images, or information. It is always suffused with non-linguistic and non-visual elements. That's deeply insightful because the internet, transmissions of words, images, or informations, they become the Godhead. But what's missing is, like he says, when you're face-to-face, you get non-linguistic, non-visual elements. You sense and feel things. And Crary continues, even when unexceptional or unmindful, the face-to-face meeting is an irreducible basis of the life world and its commonality. It is charged with the possible emergence of something unforeseen that has nothing to do with normative communication. An encounter does not occur in empty space, nor is it bounded by the frame of a screen. It is an immersion. It is an immersion in inhabiting of an atmospherics, affecting every sense, whether consciously or not. This kind of meeting, this proximity, is literally a conspiracy, a breathing together. That's what that word means. Conspiracy is with and spire to breathe together. Yet the stifling of our propensity for encounters and their responsibilities unfolds on many levels. One of the forces exacerbating this debilitation is the pervasive use of biometric procedures and related techniques to reconfigure human behavior and responses into quantifiable information. There is little in the body and brain that is not now subjected to extraordinary forms of monitoring and analysis, and an important goal of this data acquisition is to maximize and habitualize our use of network technology. And he has what historian Andreas Bernard calls the quantified self. So, yeah, it's the way the technology is measuring everybody. Measuring with the data and, see some people, they're running and they're doing their exercise. And, if it helps, it helps. I don't know. I don't do that. But, they're tracking their pulse, their heart rate. And it's like everything gets so statistics. But when it comes to the inner true self, this quantification is what he's talking about. So this is one that he highlights is that while everybody is concerned about the surveillance of the technology, he's pointing out that, and I had not heard any of this except for the facial recognition and biometrics, is all about eye tracking software and how they are studying the movements of the eyes and the attention of the eyes, and basically it's advanced advertising, studying movements to see, I don't know how they do it, but studying movements to see what people's habits are as they watch the screens. You know, what, you know, you go to some websites and it's very catchy, others it's not so much. Other ones, I mean, there's some news sites I get jittery because it's just too much information all at once and it's all melodramatic. So they're studying what colors people are drawn to, and it's all about hooking the reader to the screen. That is where the technology is being used in this eye tracking software, which he gets into in more detail. And Crary throws in a bit of history to give the context of how we got to where we are today. By the 1880s, one area of research was the functioning of attentiveness. It became important to determine its capabilities and limits, to learn how many things someone could pay attention to simultaneously and what enhanced concentration or led to distraction. Initially, these studies examined the attentiveness of workers in assembly line production, and by the early 20th century, the effectiveness of advertising, teaching methods, or any labor that depended on alertness or vigilance. This furthered the growth of enterprises that would develop into the eye-tracking industries of the present. Cumbersome machines began to be used in the 1930s, but now miniaturization has allowed eye-tracking software to be embedded in almost any device or location. Because so much economic activity depends on the constant use of digital interfaces in schools, workplace, military, entertainment, and gaming, it's obvious why the eye is now a major site of data gathering. High-tech corporations model their ambitions around an, quote, attention economy, end quote, in which financial success requires soliciting the greatest number of eyeballs. Just as time motion studies and scientific management techniques sought to make efficient the motions and work of the body during a key phase of industrial capitalism, now scrutiny of the eye serves the goal of managing an observer's vision and training the eye to be an accessory of information processing. More to the background, but that's good for now. And then for the philosopher Henri Bergson, an observer could never be understood as a mathematical point in space. A human being, he insisted, was a living center of indetermination, a position from which the world was perpetually changing, open to action, choice, and the possibility of freedom. Whatever minimized this indeterminacy or rendered perception habitual was an inhibition of life. Bergson was followed by many others over the next century who sought to resist the standardization of perception and the regulation of attention required by the industrialization of labor and new visual technologies. For eye tracking is currently one part of this larger and ongoing project of colonization. And that's exactly what it made me think of, was the little snippet that I know of quantum physics is that is exactly described there. Perpetually changing, open to action, choice, and whatever's going on in the moment, seeing where it's going. So that is where also Crary mentions too, later on towards the end of the book, he mentions the importance of having to learn from and study from traditions and peoples from the past, you know, still in the present, but those traditions that go way back that have been living with the earth consciousness and know how to get along without the technology. So this is what many indigenous people are putting forward is exactly what Crary cites. That's one of the key, also another one of the key, quote, solutions. And it contrasts, obviously, with this robotic, industrial, mechanistic, and the quantifying of everything. And when I think of, when I've seen movies, a documentary of people in the factories, Chinese factories, working on the assembly line, I just find it astounding and sad just to see. I mean, some of the people are happy, they have the job, they live in this, there was one documentary just like literally putting together like 25 or 15 irons, you know, for ironing clothes, 15 irons in like a minute. It's just the level of mechanization and production is mind-boggling, and that people are literally performing those jobs is also mind-boggling to me. So anyway, but I think that a key thing there is again, the breaking free from that, the rote repetition, the program that the technology then gets people to behave in a very programmed way. I came up with the portmanteau advertising instead of advertising. Advertising. Put another way, the more that is known about the typical patterns of eye movements, what a gaze is drawn to and what it avoids, the easier it is to contrive visual attractions that will successfully solicit or engage visual attention. Thus, the actual use of eye tracking devices is merely the means by which data is acquired, and whether any individual user has ever been tracked is irrelevant. Our concern should be that we are all increasingly inhabiting and interacting with online worlds fabricated to affect predetermined, routinized visual responses. According to one of the leading global firms, eye tracking provides compelling objective data that reveals the human behavior behind the interaction with interfaces or products and uncovers optimization potential. And that's one of those bullshit phrases that read not infrequently, that the jargon of the corporation's optimization potential. But that's what's going on, and it's in situation comedy terms, it is the laugh track. But it's not very funny, is it? All right, that's enough to think about for a while, and there's a bunch more to get to in this chapter, but that could be actually another 1 to 3 parts, because there's just so much. It's a dense book, and there's so much thought-provoking in just a few amount of pages. So thanks for listening, and be well.